The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Coming up on episode 328 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the BMW X5, eDrive 50, Toyota Sequoia, and Honda Civic. Also, Jamie Kipman takes a look at the Fisker Ocean. EV sales, contrary to popular opinion in the media, are not collapsing. Stellantis is going to partner with Ample to test out battery swapping on upcoming EVs. The end of the road for the Chrysler 300. Toyota is using Cerba Solutions to help with its battery recycling. Honda is teasing new EVs that are going to show up next month at CES. There's a new Chevy Bolt coming in 2025. We talk about the Platicy, and Tanya tells us about her visit to BMW's Silicon Valley Tech Center. And I also have a conversation with Derek Sequeira from GM Energy to talk about charging. All that and more coming up next. This is episode 328 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abul Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
I am Roberto Baldwin from SAE International. I couldn't remember where I was from for a second there.
I was just going to say, it's still new enough that you can't remember where you work. That's
where,
a good thing.
Where am I?
You're in the honeymoon period. The honeymoon period is good. Don't give that up. This is Tanya Gastic from Media Post and a variety of freelance publications.
And thank you for joining us again this week, Tanya. Why don't we start with you, since you're our guest host this week. What have you been driving?
Well, I just picked up late Friday night, so I have not been in it for very long, but I picked up a Toyota Sequoia four-wheel drive hybrid platinum version. And the thing is basically a beast. It barely fits in my driveway. I have an old school driveway, and I really have to be careful not to hit the side of the two houses. It's that big.
Ooh.
And it's a great vehicle, but you know, my first thing that I was thinking was, how is this different than the Grand Highlander? I mean, how do they not cannibalize each other?
It's less fuel efficient, and I think has less space for passengers.
Actually,
every Toyota SUV is like 2 inches bigger than the previous or SUV. They're all there's 2 inch increments.
The fuel efficiency is actually very similar to the Grand Highlander. So I don't know about that. 19 city, 22 highway for an average of 20. The Grand Highlander is 21 city. So it's a couple.
Is that with the hybrid max?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's not that much different. Here's the point of distinction. It's the towing capacity. So this thing tows, I don't know, like 9,000 pounds. The Grand Highlander only tows 5,000. So if you've got a gigantic boat, then you want to get the Sequoia.
Hella boat.
Big boat, big RV, you know, big things to tow. Then you get the Sequoia. Well, it's a beautiful vehicle. It's very luxurious inside. It's probably a little more upscale feeling than the Grand Highlander, which seems more family friendly.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially in the platinum version. But the other thing too is, I think, you know, there's probably more of a difference between real world fuel efficiency with the Grand Highlander and the Sequoia than the EPA labels might imply, because usually my experience with the Sequoia and the Tundra with that hybrid system that they have on there, it's generally not any better in fuel economy than the straight gas version.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Yeah. I haven't driven it enough to really have a good assessment of the fuel economy, but hopefully this afternoon I'll be going somewhere and I can report back next week if I'm on again.
You could tow a house.
I could tow my house. My house is small enough that I probably could pick it up and take it down the street if I wanted to. But the price, that's another point of distinction. The price on this is much higher than the Grand Hybrid or Grand Highlander, excuse me. Do you want to guess what this one is?
You get the Platinum. I'm going to say $80,000.
87.
82. How much? 82. Oh, that's close.
So I think
you would have won Price is Right.
Yep. Yeah, we go by Price is Right rules here, Tanya.
Sam wins.
Closest without going over.
Yeah, yeah. Got it. Cool.
She's like, oh, man. Why did I say I'd do this?
No, I know what Price is Right rules are. I grew up watching this show. I totally understand what that means.
Do you also subscribe to the TPIR Cars account on Instagram?
Yes, I do.
For those that don't know, TPIR Cars is an account that posts clips from Price is Right segments where they have cars that they're giving away on Instagram. And, they'll do screenshots and occasionally have some video clips on there. And they actually just had one from the other day. You know, most people are familiar with the modern iteration of The Price is Right that was hosted for millennia by Bob Barker and now Drew Carey. But the original version from the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s in black and white, the format was a little bit different. And they posted, I saw one, a clip yesterday that was from about, I want to say like 1961 or something. They had a Chrysler 300G convertible on there.
1961 Chrysler 300G.
Oh, I got it right. Okay. Yeah.
Good.
So it's, if you like seeing some of the interesting cars that Price is Right has given away over the years. You know, they've got everything from Pintos and Vegas, you know, to Transams and Corvettes and some imports as well. You know, Toyotas. It's a fun account to follow.
I love
a new car.
It's an awesome account. TPI Cars.
Anyway,
I don't even know where my phone's at. I'm not sure where I put my phone or it. Oh, wait, there's an iPad. I can just subscribe to it right now. All right, you guys keep talking.
Back to your, it's TPIR Cars. Anyway, Tanya, back to the Sequoia after that little divergence.
Yes.
Anything else? I mean, you've only had it for, for a day or so. Anything else about it, that you want to talk about?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised with the wireless Apple CarPlay. That's still always a surprise and delight feature after having been in so many cars that don't have it. And yeah, I mean, it's the screen is gigantic. It feels huge to me. I'm not sure if it even needs to be that big. How big is it? It's a 14-inch audio. I guess 14-inch isn't that big, really, but it feels really big.
I was just in a car this week that had a 17.7-inch display.
Yeah, I was going to say 14 is really nothing. What did I drive last week? I had a Civic last week. So the Civic had that little tiny screen. So compared to the Honda Civic, this is like, I mean, I loved that car, though. I have to say, I didn't get to talk about it last week because, again, I'd only been in it for a day or two. But that turned out to be a really wonderful driving experience. And I would highly, highly recommend anybody looking for a very well-equipped, comfortable, fairly inexpensive car to consider the Honda Civic.
And did you have the sedan or the hatchback?
I had the sedan.
Okay.
I think hatchback is a better option. Obviously.
Hatchback's always a better option.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And especially on this current generation, because Yeah, unlike the previous generation, which is what my wife and I have, you know, the hatchback was a little more distinct from the sedan in its shape. The current one, they basically have identical profiles on the sedan and the hatchback, except, you know, one has, you know, a much larger opening in the back if you need to put big stuff in the back, you know, fold down the back seats, as opposed to the little tiny opening that you have with the sedan.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a great car, and it's loaded. The one I had was a touring 40 touring 1.5 40 touring, fully loaded 31.9.
That's not bad.
No, it had everything. It literally had everything you could want in a car. So,
and I think Civics still start somewhere in the low 20s, like right around 23 or so, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you can't find that with very many vehicles. And, you know, the thing is they don't strip them. A lot of you see base prices like that on other manufacturers, and it's like, well, what does it have? You get a package for the steering wheel. No, almost. Yeah.
You get some vice grips that you just attach to the steering column and you just move the vice grips back and forth.
I mean, this had everything: leather trimmed seats, leather wrapped steering wheel, you know, all the fancy stuff that you get in a higher end car for $31,900.
So. Yeah, the base LX model starts at $23,950. And that, you know, still has, you know, CarPlay and Android Auto capability, you know, with the touchscreen. It does have the less powerful 2-liter four cylinder, the turbo, the 1.5 liter turbo is a nice engine.
Yeah.
That's what we have in ours.
It has 180 horsepower, but it felt very adequate. Very adequate. You can't really go by the horsepower numbers. I think the weight of the vehicle can make a huge difference there.
Oh yeah. And Hondas have always, you know, been fairly modest in terms of weight, especially cars like the Civic and the Accord. They're generally on the lower end weight wise. So
right.
All right, cool. Robbie, what about you? Did you get to drive anything this week finally?
I did not drive anything this week. I've been so busy at work, and so I didn't send them an email that said, hey, I need all these cars. And I keep like oh, I gotta send that email. I really gotta send that email. I should really send that email. So I have not had a car in like 2 weeks, maybe three at this point. And so, yeah, I really need to get on it because I'm really far behind.
All right. Well, I had the BMW X5 eDrive 50, which is the latest iteration of the X5. And in BMW's nomenclature, eDrive means that it's got electric drive. So it's a plug-in hybrid. In this case, it's not full battery electric. And for 2024, the plug-in hybrid version of the X5 and I think a couple of other models got some upgrades to the powertrain. So they got it's got a more powerful electric motor than it had before, and a significantly larger battery. I believe it used to be about a 17 kilowatt hour battery pack, 16 or 17 kilowatt hour battery pack. So now you still have the 3-liter twin turbo inline six cylinder, which is, as always, BMW's six cylinder engines are just amazing. 308 horsepower from the internal combustion, but it's now got 194 horsepower from the electric motor and 280 pounds feet of torque. So that combines to get you 483 horsepower and 516 foot-pounds of torque when you're in hybrid mode. So when you've got both the engine and the electric motor going, this thing's got some serious get up and go. I mean, that's approaching where the original BMW X5 M was a decade ago. I think that one was close to 600. But you know, you're up to almost 500 horsepower now from a plug-in hybrid. And the battery pack in this thing now is up to the total pack size is 29.5 kilowatt hours, of which 25.7 kilowatt hours is usable. And I think before, like I said, I think it was about 17 before. So it used to have like mid-20s, low to mid-20s mileage on a charge. I did my usual drive loop last week with the X5, and a mix of some highway driving, some urban, suburban driving, stop and go. It went 45 miles before the engine finally kicked on and it went into hybrid mode. And it's rated at 38 or 39, 39. So TPA rated at 39 miles of electric range. I got 45 out of it. And that was on a relatively cold day with the heater going. And you know, that's, you know, electric heat in this case. So, you know, not even ideal conditions. So, you know, if you had one of these or anything else, you know, from BMW with this powertrain, you, for almost everybody, you could do, you know, literally almost all of your daily driving without using any gas. And then, you know, in hybrid mode, it's rated at 58 miles per gallon equivalent, which is also pretty impressive. Gas only, it's 22. So the combined rating of plug-in hybrid, you know, of electric and hybrid, you know, and they've got a formula that estimates, you know, based on modeling of how people actually drive. They figure, you know, the average person will get about 58 MPGE combined between electric and gas. And then 22, you know, the X5 is a pretty big, pretty hefty, you know, mid-size SUV. You know, and to get 22 out of that in hybrid mode with the engine running is actually pretty good. It's better than I would expect. The X5 PHEV is not inexpensive though. Yeah, it's a BMW, so it's fairly pricey. The starting price for this one is $72,500. The one I drove had the Driving Assist Pro package, the M Sport package, the M Sport Professional package, the Parking Assist package, the Executive package, which gives you glass controls on, you know, for the iDrive knob and assorted other things, the Harman Kardon sound system, the Climate Comfort package with front and rear heated seats, the M Sport package Pro. Yeah, okay, that already said that up above. That gets you red brake calipers, M Sport brake calipers, because, you know, that'll make you stop at least 3 or 4 inches slower or quicker. You know, and this is a,
they don't really heat up because they're not black.
That's right. That's true. So they radiate the heat off a little bit better. So yep. All in, this came to $87,745. Which
nothing, you know, that's nothing.
It's not just inexpensive.
A C-level executive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for a loaded, you know, fairly well loaded BMW, you know, it's not crazy, but, you know, it's not an inexpensive vehicle. But, you know, it feels, you know, very premium. The seats in this thing, that you get with it are really nice, really comfortable. When you put it in sport mode, the side bolsters automatically tighten up a little bit to hold you in place a little bit better. Got heating and ventilation of the seats. The instrument cluster display, you know, is now the same thing that you find on all the latest BMWs, with one huge slab of curved glass. There's actually two separate displays behind it, one for the instrument cluster, one for the infotainment system. It's got the latest iDrive 8.5 system on there, which changes up the interface a little bit, so you can get the map display to the right, taking up about three quarters of the display, and then a column of widgets that you can scroll through on the left to get things like your media player and other stuff. It also has support for wireless Android Auto and Apple CarPlay in there. And so essentially, you know, this, if you're looking for a luxury two-row SUV that gets really good fuel economy, for particularly given the performance, you know, that 483 horsepower, you know, when you stand on this thing, it goes. I mean, it is really quick. But even when you're in electric mode, with just the 190 horsepower, it still has more, or 194 horsepower, it still has more than enough performance for, you know, for daily driving. You know, you can easily accelerate up to merge with traffic, you know, getting on the highway. As I said, you know, I did a bunch of highway driving with it, as well as a bunch of city driving, and had no problem at all running on electric alone. You know, I drove it to a meeting Monday morning in Detroit, and that's about 35 miles away, and it still had enough electricity afterwards that I was almost able to get back to Detroit Metro Airport from downtown Detroit before it finally kicked into hybrid mode. So, you know, if you're looking for a luxury two-row SUV that can be mostly electric, you know, for the vast majority of your driving, this is definitely one worth taking a look at. You want to take a guess at the destination charge?
Oh, 1300. No, wait, 1295.
Tanya, you want to guess?
Say a dollar.
I'm going to say 995.
Ooh, you win both showcases. This is exactly $995.
Oh, you get both the cars. Wow. And the jet skis and the washer dryer combo.
Yeah.
That hardly seems fair, because I was just at Test Fest driving BMW, so I was staring at
the
Monies for like 4 days.
But, I probably would have been staring at the Moni 5 minutes ago, and I still wouldn't have remembered.
But, you know, I mean, this is one of those you know, things that seems a little odd that you know, for a vehicle this expensive, that the destination charge would be so low, because, you know, we talk about things like F-150s and Rams. You know, they're charging $2,000 for destination charges. And, you know, basically it comes down to, you know, the premium brand vehicles, they're not trying to hide the price. They're just putting it right in the sticker. And, you know, instead of inflating the destination charge, you know, where you don't see it in the advertised price, they're just putting it right up front. So this is what we're going to charge you, and that's that. So it's definitely you know, not a bad deal. Plus, you know, these things are built in Spartanburg, so, you know, it's all coming from South Carolina instead of Germany.
That makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. All right, let's move on to some of the stuff that was happening this week. First off, have either of you had a chance to drive the Fisker Ocean yet?
No.
Sadly, no.
Yeah, neither have I. But Jamie Kipman got to drive one. He wrote his review for Road and Track. And,
I'll bet Fisker wishes that they hadn't given him that chance to try after reading this review.
Yeah, it was not good. The bottom line is Jamie doesn't think this thing's ready for prime time. It's not ready for customers. He said, you know, a lot of the interior felt really cheap, which surprises me, because most of the engineering on this was done by Magna. And they manufacture it. Magna Steyr manufactures these things in Austria. And, you know, I would have thought that they, you know, would have done a more robust job on a lot of this stuff. But, you know, it's hard to say what the working relationship is between Magna Steyr and their client companies like Fisker, and who ultimately makes the decisions on a lot of this stuff. But it sounds like, you know, for the Ocean Extreme that Jamie was driving, which is what I think almost $70,000.
61,499 before
destination.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Really not. I mean, it's a lot, but yeah.
It doesn't feel nearly as premium as that price would imply.
So I'm going to be the devil's advocate and say that vehicle that he drove was a lot, but if you look at the other Oceans, like the Ocean Sport, it starts at 38,900. So, and it shares probably a lot of the same parts with the one he drove. So if you're going to try to keep your prices down like that, you've got to sacrifice something somewhere.
Yeah, but I mean, even, you know, on a lot of other cars, you know, where there are more premium trim levels, you usually, you know, that's reflected in the way they finish the interior, for example. And it sounds like that wasn't the case here.
They took the least expensive trim level and threw it in all.
Just put a bigger battery and an extra motor in there.
Yeah.
And some options. But, you know, even the Ultra is priced at $52,999. Yeah, that Ocean Sport only has a range of 231 miles. It's a single motor front wheel drive and has a lithium iron phosphate battery. So it's only rated at 230 miles versus 350 rating for the Extreme. It sounds like Fisker's got more work to do. And, you know, they've had some challenges in recent weeks. They've been cutting back. They've cut back the number of vehicles they're planning to build this year, in order to save cash, because, you know, when they build the vehicles, they got to pay for the parts. And apparently they need to conserve what cash they have left to develop their next generation of vehicles, the Pear and other stuff. There are some interesting things on this. Excuse me. The big screen, it's got this 17-inch screen inside that when you're driving it, and when they first showed off the Ocean in production form a couple of years ago at the LA Auto Show, I got to walk around with Henrik on this. So when you're driving, the screen is in portrait mode, but then when you park the car, you can put it into what they call Hollywood mode, and the screen rotates 90 degrees. So when you're sitting there at a charger, for example, waiting for the battery to charge, you can put it in Hollywood mode and then use that full screen in landscape mode to watch movies, you know, or watch Netflix, whatever you want on the screen. But, you know, even with that, you know, Jamie still felt that, you know, cars like even cheaper cars than this feel a lot better, feel a lot more premium, like the Hyundai Kona, the Ioniq 5N, and the Genesis GV70. And so it's going to be tough going for Fisker, I think.
Well, it's one review. I mean,
yeah.
We'll see what others think. He may have been having a bad week. Who knows? or bad day. I think he got it for an hour. That's the other thing. I mean, can you really assess a vehicle? I mean, you can, but an hour is not a lot of time.
Yeah,
I,
he drove it during the World Car of the Year drive program in LA.
I would hesitate to write a full review after just an hour, but that's just me.
True, but you know, I mean, even in just a few minutes in the car, you can certainly get a feel for if the materials and everything feel cheap and if it feels hollow versus, you know, how reliable it is. And he didn't talk to, you know, reliability or anything like that. You know, it was just about, you know, at this price point, how does this car feel? And it sounds like it doesn't feel very premium.
Well, making cars is hard.
Yeah.
that's my takeaway. Making one car is like impossible. Making a lot of cars.
Another thing, you know, sticking with EVs. So recently there's been a lot of stuff in the media about, you know, EV sales collapsing, you know, Americans don't want EVs. I've had a lot of conversations with journalists over the past month or two.
It's tiresome.
It is so tiresome. You know, because the reality is, you know, I pulled up sales data for the US for the last 3 years. And you know, because you know, we've heard over the last few months, you know, Ford, you know, pulling back on some of their investments, EV investments, slowing down, you know, the timing for when they're gonna open one of their battery plants, cutting back their plans for another battery plant and how many EVs they want to build. Same thing at GM. And the reality is that it's more of a Ford and GM problem than it is an industry problem.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Exactly that.
Because so far through the end of November now, the Americans have bought almost 1.1 million battery electric vehicles, which is the first time ever that we sold over a million EVs in the United States. In 2022, in the full 12 months, it was 803,000. So we're on pace. We're selling about 100,000 EVs a month right now in the US. So we should be at about close to 1.2 million for end of year. 800,000 last year, 500,000 in 2021. You know, we're up to 7.4% market share for EVs. And it was 5.6 last year, 3.2% in 2021. So EV sales are up for almost everybody. you know, Tesla, you know, is still the number one purveyor of EVs in the US. Although their market share has dropped significantly for EVs, you know, their share of the US EV market has dropped significantly. Their sales are up this year, mostly because they slashed prices on the Model 3 and the Model Y and the S and the X. But their Tesla's share of the US EV market has gone from 72.5% in 2021 to 65% last year, and it's down to 56.5% so far in 2023. Meanwhile, Hyundai Motor Group, so Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis are up to 7.8% now. They're number two in terms of EV sales in the US. Volkswagen's at almost 6% of the EV market. Other, you know, even GM, let me find GM here on my chart. Even GM is at 6.4%, and Ford is just shy of 6%, 5.8%. So, you know, the panic about EV sales is more about the fact that I think Ford and GM have maybe not got the right mix of EVs. You know, and some of their prices are a little bit too high, especially for GM. The EVs that GM is actually selling in significant quantities are Chevy Bolts.
The Bolts are killing it.
Yeah.
What are we, like 76,000 so far this year? Something crazy. 70.
Let's see, Bolt. Bolt.
They need to kill more vehicles if they're going to get sales like this. You know.
Yeah, they need to. This thing sounded like crazy. Let's stop making it.
Yeah. So far this year, 22,000 Bolt EVs and 36,000 Bolt EUVs. So, 59,000 Bolts combined so far, which is like double their previous best.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they're going to stop building them in about 2 weeks.
So if you want one, you better go get it now.
Yeah.
Go get a Bolt.
Or wait till 2025.
And get a more expensive Bolt.
I don't know that that 2025 Bolt will be more expensive.
I am basing this upon the fact that everything GM and Ford has said about pricing has been incorrect.
That's true.
They always come out. They're like, yeah, it's going to be 30. We meant 35. Yeah. Oh, it's going to be 40. We meant 50. Oh, it's going to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of psych going on over at GM and Ford when it comes to EV pricing.
Next week, we'll talk about the Chevy Blazer EV. I drove that this week, but I can't talk about that till next week. So next week's show, tune in for the Blazer EV.
Blazer.
But unfortunately though, for GM, the rest of the stuff that they're selling, has been in tiny volumes. Like, so far the Blazer EV through November, they've shipped 370. Let's see, 267 Silverado EVs. You know, the Silverado was supposed to be their big winner. This was going to be the vehicle that propelled them into the lead of EV manufacturing. The reason why they're killing the Bolt right now is because they wanted to retool that factory to build more Silverados and Sierras. So far, they've sold 267, 450 of the Bright Drop electric delivery vans, and let's see, 1,000 Hummer SUVs, and 1,500 of the Hummer pickups, but they did sell 7,200 Cadillac Lyriq. So they're finally getting some traction on the Lyriq.
Well, I feel like they say that there's an issue with the automation and the battery building, which to me goes back to there's an issue with some of the engineering with the battery, that the automation isn't working on it correctly. So hopefully they've solved that issue and they can start building these vehicles at like scale. The Lyriq's a good car. I like the Lyriq.
Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, Hyundai Motor Group has sold 84,000 EVs, almost all of those, are coming from Korea. So they haven't even been eligible for tax credits this year.
Unless you lease them.
Yeah. Next year, they'll start building more of those here in the U.S. The Kia EV9 is going to be built in Georgia starting middle of next year. So there's more stuff coming. This has really been, more a story of a couple of brands than the EV industry as a whole. People actually are buying EVs when they can get them and when they're affordable. If you make them cheap enough, people will buy them.
That's true. That's true. Look at the Bolt.
Yeah.
Number one selling car. That's not a Tesla. That's an EV.
Right. And, I mentioned, the overall market share for EVs right now is 7.5% in the U.S. But for some of the premium brands like BMW and Volvo, they're like 12.5% of their sales are battery electric, and another 7.5% are plug-in hybrids. So they're doing all right.
I see so many i4s because it's a pretty good price point. Mm-hmm. It's a great car, and you're just like, I just want a car that's a BMW. I don't want to look like a space car. I just want a car that's a BMW that happens to be an EV. And like a bunch of my friends bought i4s. Yeah. No. Apparently my friends are doing better than me. They didn't become riders is what I'm trying to say.
All right. Have either of you ever heard of Ample, a company called Ample?
I've talked to them multiple times, shot videos, So yeah, I know Apple.
So Apple's an interesting company. You know, they're into battery swapping for EVs, and the whole concept of battery swapping is a really interesting one. Yeah, it's not a new idea. I mean, you know, we used to be able to do it with our phones and our computers, but you know, now they're sealed in. You know, Apple wants to bring back battery swapping. The first company to try EV battery swapping was a startup called Better Place back in 2007. And they were an Israeli startup, and they built a network of swap stations in Israel. And they were supposed to do some in the Netherlands and in Hawaii and I think in Oregon. And they were working with Renault. Renault did a version of one of their car or one of their EVs with a swappable battery. Better Place went bankrupt in 2013.
They went on to a better place.
Yeah, exactly. Then Tesla came along and they said, yeah, we can swap batteries in the Model S and the Model X. And they built one battery swap station, and they may or may not have done a handful of swaps there. But they did get a whole bunch of extra ZEV credits from the state of California that they could sell for millions of dollars. So there's that.
So they got that going for them, which is nice.
The only company that's actually had some real success with battery swapping is NIO, a Chinese EV manufacturer that now has almost 2,000 swap stations across China. And they've done something on the order of about 50 million swaps. But the thing with NIO and all these others so far is all of these companies have had, you know, one or a few vehicles that all use the same battery pack. And, you know, they all swap out the entire battery pack. But because every manufacturer uses different battery packs, different battery chemistries for all their different vehicles or most of their vehicles, and there's no standardization across the industry, you know, it makes it hard to the economics of battery swapping are tough. So Apple came up with a different approach. Instead of swapping the entire battery, they just swap modules. So just a subset of the battery, which is basically smaller batteries within a bigger battery pack. And, you know, what they came up with was a design where they use a standardized module that can be used across multiple vehicles. And then they design a pack enclosure specific to a vehicle that can hold their standard modules. And so I guess their first pilot that they did was in San Francisco. With a fleet of Nissan Leafs that were running on a ride-hailing platform. And they built custom battery packs for these and have standardized modules. And because the modules are smaller and lighter than a full battery pack, the hardware to do the robotic swapping is a lot simpler and easier to install. And now this week, Stellantis announced that they're going to work with Ample to try out their module swapping system. Starting next year with a fleet of Fiat 500Es in Madrid, that are part of the car sharing program, Free to Move. What do you think about swapping batteries as opposed to charging your EV?
For, you know, their main, when I've talked to them a few times, and they're looking at fleets because fleets make sense to them, because fleets is like, okay, we can't. You know, you need this truck to keep going, and let's say you have 100 trucks. Are you going to put 100 charging stations in your garage at night? Or you can just have them run until you need to swap them. And so it makes sense in that sense. And then also that their actual swapping stations, they're almost like IKEAs. They're like like flat packed, and they just take it somewhere. And as long as you have a slab of concrete and some electricity, you can set it up in a few days. Is sort of their selling point. Of course, once you set it up, you know, you probably have to adjust everything to make it so it works correctly. But yeah, they just like slap it down, bring it up, and it lifts your car up, and then you know everything goes underneath. So it's not they don't have to build a whole building. When you drive the vehicle into the station, it actually lifts the car up and then it swaps the battery underneath.
It's like getting an oil change, basically.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Pretty much
like an oil change, except with a little elevator. Yeah. And so they're working with Mitsubishi Fuso, which is actually part of Daimler. It's confusing. Don't think about it too hard. But yeah, no, it's interesting. Yeah, I talked to them and I see the benefits for it for fleets. For the average person, I still think it's probably pretty, I mean, especially if you could charge at home. But if there are people who are like, you know what, I live in a home that I can't charge at home for whatever reason. I don't have a driveway. I don't have a garage. I don't want to deal with the infrastructure. Maybe I could just get a car that, you know, and these vehicles have to be built for this. They, you know, you can't just go out and buy like an i4 and then take it to Ample and they'll swap it out for you. These are purpose built vehicles. So, you know, they need that deal with Stellantis. So Stellantis and that, they and Stellantis like team up to build these specially outfitted 500Es.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the challenges with their approach, you know, with if you've designed a battery pack specific to a vehicle, you know, you can really optimize the packaging to get as many cells within that pack as you can, get the maximum amount of energy capacity in there. But, you know, if you're going to use a standardized module format, depending on the size of the vehicle and how the pack fits in there, you may not because, you know, these things are, I don't know, probably about 18 by 12 inches, roughly, you know, maybe 6 inches thick. So depending on how they fit in, you know, if you imagine, you know, if you have a box, and then you're putting some blocks in there, you know, and the blocks are all the same size, but they don't, it's the interior of the box is not a perfect multiple of that block size. You know, so if it's maybe 3.5 blocks across, you know, instead of 4 blocks, then you might have some empty space, some wasted space. So depending on the particular vehicle.
I mean, you could get it, like, let's say the regular vehicle gets 300 miles. The Ample version of the vehicle will get 250.
Yeah. So you might lose a little bit of range. But, you know, depending on the use case, like, you know, in this case with Stellantis, they're doing car sharing. You know, so these are Fiat 500Es for a car sharing program that, you know, these are, you know, short-term rentals that people drive around town. You know, if they don't own a car, they can, you know, use the app, rent one of these, you know, to drive to IKEA to pick something up, and then drive home, you know, drop it off. So they're not doing long road trips with these things. So the range is not so much of a problem. And, you know, with gas powered cars and car sharing services, you know, the staff of the car sharing service can, you know, when the car is getting low, they can go pick up the car, take it to a gas station, fill it up, take it back, you know. With charging, you know, that now they have to potentially, you know, sit around for an hour or more, you know, waiting for it to charge. But with swappable batteries, they can just take it to a nearby swap station. It takes less than 5 minutes to swap, and then they go back and drop it off on the street somewhere where another renter can pick it up. So it makes perfect sense for this kind of use case where you don't necessarily need the absolute maximum amount of range, but you want it. You want maximum uptime. You don't want the car sitting around unusable for any extended period of time.
So Teslas are becoming big for Uber drivers in Detroit, believe it mm-hmm. or not. And I've talked to a number of them while I've been charging my whatever I'm driving for the week, and they are really not sure how to feel about it because they're spending a lot of time at the charging station, you know, when they could be out driving people and making more money. So in a case like just for Uber, say, for example, or Lyft, it could make perfect sense.
Yeah. And this
you're not driving, you're not making money.
Right. And this is the same problem that Hertz had that they talked about in their Q3 earnings. You know, they've over the last couple of years, they bought 35,000 Teslas and 15,000 Polestar 2s that they put in their fleet. And they have plans to buy, you know, many thousands more. You know, they over the, you know, the rest of the decade, they would ultimately like to get almost their entire fleet to be electric. But one of many problems that they've had, in addition to things like, you know, very high repair costs for the Teslas, is the charging. You know, with their gas powered vehicles, at busy locations like airports, you know, when you go to a Hertz outlet or Avis or Budget, you know, at an airport, at a major airport, when cars come in, they're usually turning those cars, you know, cleaning them, making sure they're gassed up, you know, checking them out, and they're going back out with another renter in 20 to 30 minutes, which with an EV, if a customer brings it back uncharged, you know, now it's sitting around potentially for, you know, a couple of hours or more.
So I was one of those customers who got a Hertz Tesla, and I will tell you the penalty for not bringing it back fully charged. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was way higher than if you don't bring back a gas vehicle fully blow, you know. Fully.
Right, and that's because it, you know, the cost to Hertz is not just, you know, the cost of the electricity, but the lost cost, you know, the time that they can't rent that car.
So I stopped at a Tesla, you know, station on my way back to the airport. It was not a big deal.
Right. And you know, if there is a station nearby, then that's fine. But, you know, sometimes, you know, if you're renting, you know, if you're not used to driving an EV and you don't plan for an extra half hour, you know, or 40 minutes to charge it, you know, and you're in a hurry, you know, you just go drop it off. Or if there's no charging station nearby the airport. And this is one of the problems that Hertz also has, is they don't necessarily have the charging infrastructure at a lot of their sites. And so, you know, they're having to send staff out with the cars to public charging stations to charge them. So they're paying for those people to sit around and wait while the cars charge. So, you know, if they had, you know, something like battery swapping, that they could potentially be turning cars around a lot faster.
Yeah, no, it sucks because they used to be able to get those EVs cheaper. And after that, that call, now they're more expensive than the cheaper car. Could you get them like on a deal? Because I could get a Tesla. Because we're in SAE's International's headquarters is in near Pittsburgh, so I could fly in, get a Tesla, and then I could charge it at work because we have a charge point at work.
Yeah,
I was like, wee! So it was like free. Like it was like free. Well, I mean, it wasn't free, but you know, the company still pays for it, but they're paying less than if I like, you know, rent a gas car. I just show up every morning and I plug in the Tesla and then I take it back to Hertz. And I think you have to be at 80%. So the last day I just, you know, charge it to 100 and at the end of the day, I'm done.
Yeah.
But not anymore. Boo.
All right. Let's stick with Stellantis for a minute. The Chrysler 300, one of the last of the classic American big sedans, even though it's built on a German design platform, is reaching the end of the road. This week, Chrysler built the last of the 300 Cs, which is a special edition, version that they launched earlier this year, with a 485 horsepower Hemi V8. And then sometime in the next couple of weeks, you know, probably right before Christmas, when they shut down for the Christmas break, they will be building the last Chrysler 300 of any kind, or at least, you know, of this generation of 300s. So it's the end of the road for the 300. What do you two think about the 300?
Bring back the Magnum. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
That's what I think about the 300.
That model is incredibly popular in Detroit. You know,
just
I live
keeps
in the
going.
City of Detroit, and I don't know what people are going to drive in Detroit, because I would say half of the cars I see in my neighborhood are 300s. It's just the most popular model. And I'm thinking, and they're not. So, you know, Detroit people are sort of US big three centric. So I'm thinking, what else is there, you know, from Chrysler, Ford or GM that they're going to drive? I guess they're going to all have to switch to Cadillacs, the one Cadillac sedan that's left.
Well, the only other Chrysler model still in production is the Pacifica. Yeah.
Yeah, minivan.
And there's supposed to be a bunch more new Chryslers, you know, electric Chryslers coming starting in 2025. And for now, all you got is the Pacifica. And there's nothing else really like the 300. You know, and of course the Charger is also going away the end of this month. There's not really any other large, you know, traditional American sedans.
It's big, bah.
Yeah.
No, that thing just keeps going. It's never. I figured they would just keep. They would just keep making them until the very last day, and then there'd still be a guy at like at 2 a.m. making like four more. I got to make this last four.
Yeah. Well, that last day is coming up pretty soon. So Nope.
Well, and you don't have it down as one of the stories we're talking about, but you know, they also announced that they're killing the Renegade this week.
Oh yeah.
They actually announced it. So I take complete credit for that because last week I talked about how great the Renegade was.
Oh, so it's your fault.
And the exact same thing happened with the Chevy Bolt. The exact same thing. I did a review of the Chevy Bolt and they killed it the next day.
What did you talk about this week? Before everyone go out and buy this before Tanya kills Tanya. So, Tanya's killing Honda spree.
The Toyota Sequoia and the Honda Civic.
I think those vehicle. Actually those are fine.
Those are okay. But fine. I just think it's, you know, I went on and on last week about how great the Renegade was, and then press release comes out like 3 days later. We're killing it.
Yeah. I mean, I actually like the Renegade, for a small crossover, yeah, it's actually pretty capable off road as well. So it's a shame that one's going away.
It's got a cool name, Renegade. Yeah.
But I suspect we might see a replacement in the next year or two, that's electric. So
the electric Renegade. Use the name though. Keep Renegade. Yeah. That's a good
bring
name.
It back. Well, I mean, they brought the 300 back. The 300 was dead. They brought it back. So this could be a temporary death. You know, it could come back as an electric, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
Like Lazarus from the grave.
All right. Toyo, you know, we talked about battery swapping, but there's also battery recycling. You know, once batteries are no longer useful for swapping into a car, you need to dispose of them somehow. And there's, you know, there's a few companies out there that are starting to do recycling of lithium ion batteries. Redwood Materials is probably the best known one. It was founded by J.B. Straubel, the former CTO of Tesla. And there's also Li-Cycle and a few others out there. But one of the challenges is kind of figuring out the business model. You know, is you sell a car with a battery in it when it's built. And then when either the vehicle or the battery reaches the end of its useful life on the road, you know, there has to be a process to get that battery from the car to the recycler. And so there, you know, there's a bunch of companies working on this, you know, but, you know, trying to figure out the value chain, who owns the battery at various stages of its life, who gets paid for it, you know, because when part of the reason why we recycle batteries is because there's a lot of valuable materials in there. Well, who's going to benefit from the value in those materials? And so Toyota announced this week that they're partnering with a company called Serba Solutions. And there's a couple of others out there. There's another company I met recently called Currents that's doing this. But with Toyota and Serba, they are developing a logistics network to handle end-of-life batteries from hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and battery electric vehicles. And right now for Toyota, you know, there's not many end-of-life battery electric vehicles, but there's certainly, you know, they've been selling hybrids for 25 years now. And so there's many millions of these things.
They've sold 6.2 million combined hybrid and plug-in hybrids since 2000.
And that's just in the U.S.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's about, I think globally, the number is about 25 million. You know, as those vehicles reach the end of life, you know, you got to deal with those batteries. And so they're working with Serba to set up a process for collecting those batteries and distributing them to the various recycling facilities around the country.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. So when you go and you go to buy a new car, do you like, okay, we're going to give you this much. Is there going to be a base price based on how much, you know, battery capacity or what the size of the battery is? You're like, okay, well, you have 100 kilowatt hour battery pack, so you get, you know, $500 extra dollars in addition to whatever we'll give you for this vehicle or something, or I don't know. One more thing just to figure out. They won't give you anything and everyone makes money but you.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
That's probably more likely.
Yeah.
The scenario.
It's a huge problem that they need to figure out. And you know, I've had a number of consumers say to me they won't buy an EV because they're environmentalists and they say, what are they going to do with these batteries? It's a problem. They need to figure this out before I buy an EV.
But there's they can just use the internet and look up EV recycling, because there's lots of people doing it. Are they still driving gas cars? Because that's also an issue. I mean, if they're riding bikes, then that's a non-issue. They're just making up excuses.
Yeah. With this announcement, Toyota, projects that they're going to reduce their overall transportation and logistics costs for battery recycling by about 70%. When cars, reach the end of their life, they go to a wrecking yard at some location, and there'll be battery recycling plants around the country. But what you don't want to do is take a battery. Ideally, you don't want to take a battery, from a car, an end of life EV or hybrid in, Seattle and ship it to South Carolina, which is where Redwood is building their next recycling plant. You want to, and you don't want to take the batteries, onesie, twosie here and there. So what some of these companies are doing is developing plans to aggregate. So, when wreckers get in an EV or a hybrid, they can go online, and there'll be there's a company called Currents that's developing a marketplace for this, and they're working with automakers to, you can put in the VIN number of the car. It'll give you the information of the battery, the estimated value of that battery. And then the wrecker can say, yep, I'm good with that price. And then they will send around a truck to pick up the batteries. And, it'll be kind of like, not so much like Amazon Prime, but there, there's some other services where, if you can, kind of like Prime. If you want it picked up right away, they'll give you one price for it. But if you'll hang on to that battery for a week or two until you get some more batteries,
they'll give you a $3 digital credit.
they'll give them more money for that battery. Because then they can get a whole truckload of batteries together instead of taking them one at a time. So it saves a lot of energy and cost that way. All right. still with EVs, Honda is one of the few automakers that actually is planning to be at CES next month. Most of the other automakers have pulled out. Hyundai and Kia are going to be there. Mercedes-Benz is going to be there. And so is Honda. And Honda is going to be showing off at least concept versions of their new EVs that are coming in 2026. And they released a teaser image this week. It's quite a departure. I mean, we see kind of the front end of this car, and if this is actually what the new Honda EVs are going to look like, it's quite different from what we've seen up till now from Honda.
Look out, Cybertruck. This is as weird as you are.
Yeah.
It'll last 100 years.
Yeah. It's wedge shaped. Kind of a flat front. It doesn't look like anything we've seen from Honda up until now. That's for sure.
Yeah. We'll see how far these are concepts or design, experiments the concept car is such a, the variety of what they can be. You're like, well, what's it? Oh, this is just an idea we had.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
this is like near, in some places they're like, oh, this is like 80% production.
Well, yeah. I mean, at CES this year, Stellantis showed off the Ram Revolution concept and told us, this is pretty close to what our electric Ram pickup's going to look like. And then 3 months later, they showed us the Ram 1500 Rev. And apart from the tuning fork headlights, it looked almost nothing like the concept.
Well, they were pointing. You just weren't paying attention. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
They're just pointing right at the line. There you go. This is pretty much exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, this is what the headlights are going to look like. The rest you can forget about.
The headlights will look like, yeah. And so, Honda has a current design language that they're doing, so we'll see if these are, they're talking about like 30 EVs by 2030, 2040. One of those decades.
Yeah, Honda's current design language, they're in the part of their cycle. They tend to oscillate back and forth between really interesting designs and kind of boring designs. Not bad, just boring. And right now they're kind of in the boring phase. So, you know, there looks like, you know, maybe they're going a little more daring with this next generation.
They're going to have more Type R stabby cars coming.
Yeah.
Sharp edges, giant wings, terrifying the olds.
All right. I was watching some YouTube videos the other day, and something interesting popped up when one of the videos finished that looked fascinating. It was about the build of something called the Platicy. So this guy's got a YouTube channel. Basically took a Model S Plaid that he had bought off of Copart. You know, that it had been in a crash and had been totaled, but the powertrain and the battery were still functional, and put a Honda Odyssey body on it. Because, you know, the Odyssey has a similar wheelbase and a similar width to the Model S. And so I said, what the hell? Let's make a Honda Odyssey Plaid. And it actually came out pretty interesting.
Well, the minivans are awesome. More people should have minivans. So the fact that you can now have a, I guess if you're rich, you can buy an old Plaid and throw a minivan on top of it and have the best of both worlds, I guess. Although, you know, scaring the children. Everyone strap in. Oh, gosh, Dad, why?
Yeah, three motor electric Honda Odyssey. I'm in for it. The video is pretty long. It's about an hour, but it goes through the whole process. You know, he actually ended up buying a couple of, you know, in addition to the Plaid that they used as the donor car for this, bought another one that had been crashed and largely destroyed to use to prototype it all. I mean, they went through, you know, a lot of work to make sure that this would actually, that this, everything could actually fit together and figure out what they had to modify. But, you know, at the end, you know, they have what looks like a relatively standard Odyssey, aside from the bigger wheels and tires. Some mismatched body panels that, you know, came from various donor vehicles at the wrecking yard.
It's called a sleeper. That's what that's for.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't look like anything that offers this kind of performance level.
I remember in the 90s, people were buying like Astro, like the Chevy Astro.
Oh, yeah.
They would lower them and they put big stereos in them. Like that was the heyday of the minivan. And now it's just me and, like, you know, other automotive journalists be like, you should get a minivan. I was looking at a text thread I had with a cousin who like 2 years ago was like, I need a new car. I'm like, well, you have the kids, right? I'm like, yeah, I'm like, just get a minivan, get an Odyssey, get a Sienna, a Pacifica. She's like, no, they're not cool. No. I'm like, no, minivans are awesome. It's way better than SUV. And I'm trying to explain, I'm like, imagine you're carrying your child and you're walking up to your vehicle. You can just tap a button and the door slides open. And then you have this huge space, this huge opening in order to put your child in the car seat, do all the stuff, toss all the things, hit the button and close.
Not have to reach up in the air.
Or you can just push the button and it opens.
Practical. Yeah. And they're so comfortable. I mean, the Pacifica, even for me, is with no kids. I loved that vehicle, having that.
We rent them all the time.
They're awesome.
We go on road trips.
Wonderful vehicle.
We go on road trips with the dogs. We're like, well, let's just get a Pacifica.
Yeah.
You know, we just rent a minivan and we'll get a Pacifica. We'll end up with like a Sienna hybrid. And we're like, yeah, it's nice. It's comfortable. They're plenty powerful because we end up having to go up in the mountains. And, you know, it's fine. The dogs are happy. We have room for stuff. And, you know, if I do band things on that trip, then there's room for band things. No, the minivans are awesome. So much room for activities.
All right. Tanya, this week you went to Silicon Valley. You're out in Robbie's neck of the woods. Why don't you tell us why you were there?
In lieu of CES, I mean, BMW is still going to be at CES, but in a very small way. They had a bunch of auto journalists and other folks there for it was their 25th anniversary of their tech center in California. And they showed us it was the North American premiere of the new Vision Neue Klasse, which they're definitely going to make. It's a concept vehicle now, but it is coming in 2025. And they are for sure making it because they gave us Hot Wheels versions.
Oh, what? Okay, hold on. I went all the way to Germany to see that thing, and I didn't get any toys. Now I'm angry. I'm going to send an email to Alex, right?
And they didn't have any toys there either.
Yeah, I'm sending so excited.
Tom, Alex, and they're all getting angry emails from us because we didn't get toys.
I also got a 25th anniversary pin that weighs about a pound. They gave
just like your shirt is like,
and my lapel is like, I can't actually wear it. But we got to see at the North American, and we got to open the doors, and actually we couldn't sit in it, but we were able to like kind of lean into it and take pictures, which I guess you guys couldn't do in Germany. So I feel slightly special. And then the day before that, we went to different workshops. So they split us into small groups, and we went to a workshop on intelligent personal assistant, which they talked about their new technology for. They showed us basically what the new Mini is going to have next year, which is an improved version of their current intelligent personal assistant. They're bringing this very animated, cool character. It's a dog named Spike. Yeah. So we got to meet Spike, which was cool. And then they had an AR VR journey. That was another workshop where they showed us sort of the evolution of how the AR VR glasses have changed and how they're going to change going forward. They're working with Meta. We went out to Levi's Stadium and got to ride in a car wearing these VR glasses that they've developed with Meta to sit in the back seat and be able to, you know, do different things. You can take a call, and it's hard to even explain. And then we did another workshop, and I'm not going to keep blabbering on here. The last workshop was the innovation mindset workshop, which was like the really futuristic stuff, including a new scent experience called Atmospheres. It's still in testing phase, but it's and then we got to go to Levi's.
Smellorama in your new BMW.
Well, it's
like different. The Mercedes.
No, it's not like any other. I mean, they currently have a scent module that you can buy and put into your BMW. This is actually interesting in that it's controlled by part of like what you're doing. So if you're leaving work and it gets to know you. So if it knows you're leaving work, it's going to give you a special kind of scent. If it knows you're going to work, it's going to give you a special scent package. If you're going to the gym, say for, you know, a Pilates class, if you're going to a Pilates studio, it's going to prepare you for that Pilates class by giving you a certain scent experience.
Aromatherapy for your drive.
And it's GPS based, which is new. I mean, that's not something any other automaker has done so far. So it was
now,
interesting.
My question is, are they going to require a subscription to get these scent cartridges?
Oh, they're not that far. they're not that close to it. They I'm sure they will.
Yeah, I would bet they'll at least try that.
Yeah,
it'll be like subscribing to ink cartridges for your printer.
Yeah, HP.
Well, and I did get to do an hour-long session with a roundtable with Stephen Durek, who's their SVP of connected company development for BMW. And I did put him on the spot about, you know, how GM is getting rid of Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. And he said, no, we're not doing that. We want our customers to have choice. So that was interesting.
No, we're not doing that.
Yeah, he said it's important for customers to have choice.
They say that now, but my guess is within 5 years, they will have a very different attitude.
They have to they have to be better than Apple CarPlay. Then you say, you know what? It's so much better than Apple CarPlay at this point.
Exactly,
then you get rid of it.
That's how you do it. They're making their native system so good that people aren't going to want the alternative. So that's their goal. I mean, they'll keep offering both, but eventually nobody will be wanting the Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. So then they'll switch to the native system.
GM's doing it the cold turkey way. And stay tuned on Wednesday. I'll have a video walkthrough on the Blazer for patrons. If you're a Patreon supporter of the show, you can already see that video. And then on Wednesday, everybody else will be able to get a look at that.
Check it out.
Cool.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. There was an email, a listener email. I completely forgot to put it in here.
Questions. So many questions. What's the deal with Robbie? And then you say, oh, we don't know.
Oh, here we go. From Lawrence Lucero. Let me just make sure we didn't do this one last week. Why do I feel like we already did this one? No, we didn't. Okay. So this is from Lawrence Lucero. Lawrence in the desert, more specifically, who drives a 2020 Civic Si. Save the manuals. Says, hello, gang. I wanted to get your opinion on something I do not understand. In reference to your story about guidance to avoid bedazzling the steering wheel, that's something we talked about a couple weeks ago. I wonder why driving instruction and schools do not expose new drivers to airbag deployment. And I mean a real in-person deployment, not just a video. I doubt that many new drivers would consider installing covers on the airbag or sitting so close to them if they were exposed to that. Why should they wait until an accident to learn the potential for harm, even from this life-saving device? I see many drivers and passengers that seem to be oblivious to how violent they can be when they sit up, sit super close, or putting their feet on the dash. There are many videos of pranks using airbag inflators that launch people into the air. It may even be an opportunity for a warning label on the steering wheel that could help save new drivers from ever going through that. With so many drivers being killed, I wonder why there does not seem to be any push to help teach young drivers without waiting until it's too late. Anyway, just wanted your take. Thanks for the content, and just ordered a shirt. Thanks, Lawrence. And for those of you that want a wheel bearing shirt, shop.wheelbearings.media. It'll take you to our store on Cotton Bureau. Got a couple of different designs, lots of colors available. So, go get your wheel bearing swag. So airbags, and driver training, what do you think?
I think it's Darwin. And I think the dumb people are killed by their airbags and we should go on because
is it Darwin if you don't understand how it works? If you're ignorant because no one's actually taught you how it works.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's assume, you haven't bedazzled your steering wheel.
The feet on the dash thing. I don't think people understand like what's going to happen if there's an accident. I think they're like, oh, I'm just putting my feet up. Da, da, da. You're just or driving with your hand on top of the steering wheel. Like you don't understand what's going to happen if the airbag goes off.
They're teaching kids now in driving school to drive at 9 and 3. Below, like whatever that is, 7 and 5. It used to be 10 and 2. And so they are teaching them to keep their hands down below and they're telling them why.
But are they giving them the contextual issues? I think there's an opportunity to at least I mean doing it in real life, that's gonna be expensive. And schools
it's
don't
really
have
expensive
any,
to deploy.
Schools don't have money. I think it has to be a video, but you have to have a dummy, like the little dummy with this little feet up, and then you just blow the airbag and you see the little leg just snap off, or with your hand up on top, all the weird little things that you don't think about because they're like, okay, you got to be 9 and 3. All right, fine. And that changed. I think they changed that like 10 years ago or whatever. Now they're, 7 and 5 below. I think you're just telling, this is why, and this is what's going to happen. But if you show them versus telling them, I think there's going to be a bigger impact.
So maybe we should make a video.
We should make a video.
Wheel bearing should produce this video.
We'll go borrow a few cars from automakers and crash them into walls and set up our GoPros in there so you can see what happens to us when
put them all to slow motion.
Yeah.
I went to when that BMW thing, I also went to the recycling center over in Germany and they let me blow all the airbags in a car with a little thing. And it's like, it's not a, like, a, it's like they're, it's in a room and like, I was like 20 feet away from the car and everyone had to get away from the car. And we had earplugs and like goggles, a hat. And I had like a little control module and it's not something you could just like, hey, let's just do this. But and BMW, Volvo, some automaker has an opportunity to sort of show off because they have all the equipment and they have all the cameras and they have all the things they could do this and they could create that, throw it on YouTube, and then schools could do
could
it. And then, there's also like, the way school driver training has sort of evolved into there's fewer and fewer hours of driver training. I mean, when I was in school, I had to take a whole semester of driver training. Like the whole, like that was a whole class. And then I found out later they don't do that anymore.
No.
Just, yeah. Now they very few schools.
Couple do hours. That anymore. That's it. Couple hours.
And then we wonder why no one knows how to drive. I'm
like, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we're not going to teach them. Well, how come no one knows how to drive? I don't know. When we were young.
And you know, most young drivers have never experienced, you know, a lot of the technologies that are in vehicles like ABS, like traction control, stability control, a lot of the safety equipment. You know, when my kids were younger and they were learning to drive, I actually did take them out into an empty parking lot, you know, as soon as we had snow on the ground, and, you know, had them try out, you know, slam on the brakes, you know, so they could experience what ABS feels like.
You know, don't pump your brakes. Do not pump your brakes.
Do not pump your brakes
on the brake pedal.
Yeah, just press.
Still like teaching that, the pumping of the brakes. It's like, oh my God, we're so far away from that.
And
you know, driving like a 1980 car.
Yeah, pulling the parking brake to practice some skid control. You know, so I'd pull the parking brake, you know, at random, and you know, have them respond so that they were used to what it feels like. Very few, unless you send your kids to you know, like a racing school, you know, where most racing schools actually do have specific young driver programs as well.
BMW does,
you know, Bondurant, all these, you know, and they use skid cars to do that. So you actually get to experience that stuff. But something like airbag deployment, unfortunately, the nature of how that works, you know, it's basically one and done. You know, once an airbag goes off, you have to throw away the whole mechanism. Now you could simulate some of that. It's not going to be the same, but, to cycle every kid in the class through that, so they experience it firsthand. First of all, you'd have to have some kind of mechanism, you know, to give you the deceleration. So you really experience what it feels like, rather than just sitting there in a seat, in a stationary seat with an airbag going off in front of you. That's not going to give you the full effect. So unfortunately, you know, it's not really a practical alternative. You know, ideally, you know, if you could even take kids to a place where they do crash tests so they could actually see it in person, you know, that gives you a lot more of the impact of the sound, you know, and how violent an occurrence this is when a vehicle crashes and when the airbags go off. But you know, there's not that many places where you can do that practically, and they don't cycle through that many tests where you could get all young drivers through that. So unfortunately, we're going to have to rely on videos, but we do need to do a better job of educating people of things like, don't, you know, on any vehicle that's got a passenger side airbag, really, actually, even if it doesn't have an airbag, don't put your feet up on the dash.
Don't put your feet up on the dash.
If there's a crash, airbag or not, you know, your feet, your legs are going to get mangled.
You're going to have a bad time is what's going to happen. Yeah, no, it's.
And I think that was it. Let's see, did we? Okay, yeah, that's all we've got for right now for questions. So I was in California this week to drive the Chevy Blazer EV, and we'll talk about that next week. But I did get a chance to talk with Derek Sequeira, who is the head of product for consumers for GM Energy, which is the business unit of GM that's doing all the stuff around charging. And so we had a good conversation about what GM's doing around charging. Talked about the EVgo partnership, what they're doing with Pilot, and GM just had some announcements this week with that. So they, a couple of years back, they announced they were going to do 3,200 urban DC fast charging locations with EVgo, putting them in places like grocery stores and shopping centers. They've already got about 1,000 of those deployed, and they're moving quickly to get the rest of them. They've also got a program, a partnership with Pilot Travel Centers, so truck stops, putting in 500 of those at Pilot truck stops, And those will be, they've got the first about a dozen or so now. And by the end of the month, they will have 25 of those in place. And the nice thing about those is they're putting in pull-through chargers on those. So if you are using an EV to tow a trailer and you're on a road trip, you want to charge, you'll want to look for these pilot travel centers that will have pull-through charging facilities there. And we also talked about what they're doing around home charging and the joint venture that was announced a couple months ago with a bunch of other automakers. So have a listen to that interview right after this, and we'll talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody, it's Sam. This week I was in California to drive the new Chevy Blazer EV, and I can't tell you about that yet. It's still under embargo. But I did have a chance to chat with Derek Sequeira, who is the director of product for residential at GM Energy. And we talked talked for about 20 minutes or so about charging. And so have a listen. I think you'll hear, learn some interesting stuff in here about what GM is doing. All right. So, Derek, GM Energy is something that most consumers probably aren't familiar with yet. And charging, as we've heard, is a major issue. You know, I think the two biggest barriers to EV adoption are affordability of the vehicles and charging. Mm-hmm. And we've certainly heard a lot of bad stuff about a lot of the public charging out there. Mm-hmm. But what is GM doing to address the challenge of charging for EV customers?
Absolutely. So at GM Energy, you know, we're pioneering solutions for all of our customers, whether they're at home, public, or commercial. Our goal is to really take away some of those barriers that you mentioned when it comes to charging, range, anxiety. And it all starts with education, right? So education is really the first building block that we're working on. And for that, we're building out tools. So EV Live, I think you're familiar with, is something that we've got out there to get some of those EV intenders, those that have the
or EV curious
curiosities or are getting the wrong information from social media or my grandmother or whatever the case may be. So EV Live's our first line of defense, right? To get the information out there. Also, we want to make sure we're working with our dealers to build up the education piece as well. So we've got some really great programs that our dealers are engaging with, including EV Live, to help bridge the education gap. So that's one piece. Beyond that, it's making sure we've got great solutions for the home. Because as most of us know, the majority of charging in an electric vehicle is likely going to happen at home, over 80%. So we are building out not only a great product ecosystem for the home, starting with chargers that put energy into your vehicle, but very shortly, we'll be introducing our new GM Energy home ecosystem that will introduce bidirectional charging to pull energy out of your vehicle. So that's the way we're tackling it on the home side. So you mentioned public charging. That's something that customers who don't have access to good home charging or are power users, as we say, are going to have to encounter.
Well, and especially if we look forward, I mean, today, you know, the reality is, you know, new vehicle sales are only a small portion of total vehicle sales.
Oh, yeah.
We sell a lot more used vehicles every year than new vehicles. And for new vehicle customers and people purchasing new vehicles, most of them are, you know, going to have access to home charging. And yeah, they're going to do most of their charging at homes. You said 80% or more. Mm-hmm. Once these vehicles get into the used vehicle market a few years from now, you have a much higher percentage of people who are renters or apartments or condos, and they're going to be reliant on that public charging.
Right.
And that's where we've got the real problem.
It is. Multi-unit dwellings are a huge problem. On the public charging side, though, what we want to do is make that public charging very accessible to the customer. So in your My Chevrolet app, when you get that used Bolt or that used Blazer, you've got the ability to get in there and access over 164,000 level 2 and DC fast chargers across the United States and Canada. The bonus there is through our OnStar system, you have the ability to take the data from the vehicle so state of charge, and use that in your route planning so that you can get from Detroit to Chicago on the appropriate state of charge, but it'll also lead you to the right chargers along the way. So 164,000 is where we start. But we're continuing to invest in building chargers as well. Because you know what? For the longest time, it was, hey, somebody else is going to deal with that. But at GM, we believe we're part of the solution. So we've announced our EVgo build in the metro areas, our pilot Flying J project, which we just updated everybody on yesterday to get 25 of these completed by the end of the year, and then continue the progress throughout 2025 and beyond. We also are opening up the supercharger network to our customers early in Q1, which adds another 15,000. So if you're keeping track, we're starting to get in some big numbers. Add that to the 30,000 with our joint venture with the seven OEMs, and now you're really talking choice for customers to get to public charging. So that's how we're addressing availability. Beyond that is reliability.
Right. So that's my next question.
You mentioned
how is GM, you know, with the various partners you have, whether it's EVgo and with Pilot and the joint venture, what are some specifics that you're going to do to ensure that all these tens of thousands of chargers that are being deployed are actually working when customers get to them?
Yeah. So in every project that we are investing in, we're putting in some very stringent service level agreements to get really high uptime. And working with these providers to make sure that our vehicles are compatible with their hardware and that we're doing integration together to really make sure that if there is a problem, we don't want it to be the vehicle. We don't want it to be the hardware. You know, you want it to be something like, hey, maybe someone drove over the charger. Those are the small things that eventually we're going to have to figure out how to fix, but we want to rule out the pieces that are within our control. And it's super important for us to make sure that we're holding each other accountable to these high uptimes.
So one of the challenges with using public charging today is, you know, oftentimes you will look in the app or look in OnStar, Google Maps, wherever, and it'll tell you where there's a charger, and you get there and it's in the back corner of, you know, some dark corner behind a mall.
Yeah.
You know, if you get there in the evening, it might be closed.
Mm-hmm.
There's no canopy. There's no signage. You know, when you drive down the road, there's a 30-foot high sign for every gas station. You know exactly where those gas pumps are.
Mm-hmm.
Actually finding those chargers can often be difficult. And the experience when you're there, I mean, if you're sitting there for 20, 30, 40 minutes to charge, you know, there's often nothing to do. And so how are you addressing that challenge?
Yeah. So in the projects that we're investing in, let's take the Pilot Flying J project. We are looking at ways to make that experience much better. So by signing up with a partner like Pilot Flying J, you have amenities that are there, amenities that are great, that truckers, drivers are using all the time. And now as an EV driver, you have access to that. On top of it, we are building out good experience for customers by investing in things like canopies to protect you when the snow's out, when it's pouring rain, so that you don't need to worry about that when you're out in public charging. So that's the first example. But as we look to some of these new projects, we'll continue to iterate on that and look for better ways to make charging more convenient and more friendly for customers.
And the first project, the urban charging network with EVgo.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, 3,250 planned chargers that are part of that. And is about 1,000 of those are now deployed?
Yeah, a little over 1,000.
And where are those being deployed?
So we're deploying those in metro areas across the United States. Some would be in shopping plazas and places where we know that customers are going to congregate to. They have time to go and charge, maybe stop in, get their groceries, and continue on their way.
And will those have some of the, obviously they've got amenities like shopping and things like that, but will they, you know, also have things like canopies as well associated with them?
For the first batch, you know, we've built them out. I think we'll continue to look for opportunities in some of the future builds to have those. But as of right now, we're going to sort of continue on the deployment as is.
Okay. Now,
we're here to drive the new Blazer EV, but sitting over here is a Silverado EV.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why people buy those big trucks is for towing.
Yeah.
And anybody that has tried to charge an electric truck with a trailer hooked up has found a rather challenging experience.
Yes. So. You can't back in.
Yeah.
So in these investments, we are also looking at amenities like pull-through charging so that you can have the confidence that I'm out on that road trip. I'm going to that Pilot Flying J, and I can fit my
making sure that some of those chargers are set up that way so you can do that. Okay. Because, the last thing you want to do is, every couple of hundred miles, pull in somewhere, unhook your trailer, go charge your truck, then hook the trailer back up, then do that all again 3 hours later.
It's going to lead to poor experiences in electric vehicles, which we know by driving it is not a poor experience. Right. It's actually a pretty amazing experience.
Yeah, driving an EV is a great experience. Owning one, sometimes not so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because and primarily because of the user experience around charging.
Yeah.
So, it's good to hear that's something that you're addressing. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier Tesla having access to, you mentioned the supercharger network.
Yes.
I don't think you actually used the word Tesla. You mentioned the supercharger network.
Mm-hmm.
And early in 2024, that will start rolling out. So presumably you'll have an OTA software update to the vehicles that are out there to enable that. And and also an adapter?
We haven't put forth our strategy yet. Our plan is in early 2024 to give everyone an update along with how we're going to get adapters into hands of customers who want to be able to access those networks.
Okay. And for all of the thousands of chargers that you're also investing in, at some point, presumably, the ones that are out there will get updated with NACS connectors, and new ones will be built with both NACS and CCS.
So as we work through the projects, we're going to continue to build out CCS, and as our portfolio starts to switch over, we'll look at opportunities to add NACS chargers, because we want to make sure we've got charging infrastructure out there that's accessible to everybody, whether they bought an EV today or they're going to buy one in 2025.
Okay. So a lot of great progress being made, and I think certainly targeting the right things, I think, to improve that experience for EV owners. So I'm glad to see this happening. Let's talk a little bit about the GM Home Energy, GM Energy Home stuff, and what you're doing there.
Yeah, so with GM Energy Home, as I mentioned earlier, we are trying to unlock more value for the customer at their moment of electrification. And by introducing concepts such as bidirectional charging, you can take the stored energy in that Blazer EV, that 102 kilowatt hour battery, and utilize it for what you need as a customer. And the first use case that we want to make sure we've got available is vehicle to home. So providing resiliency to customers in the event of a blackout, an outage. Because we know there's some jurisdictions around here in the U.S. where the grid is fragile, right? It's old infrastructure.
We're here in California.
It hasn't been upgraded. So why can't the customer take the power within their vehicle and use that when they need it the most? So we're building a product ecosystem to support that. It all starts with our first bidirectional charger, the PowerShift. The PowerShift gives you 19.2 kilowatts of AC charging. So you can take advantage of the fastest AC charging we offer, like on the Silverado EV, but then have the ability to harness 9.6 kilowatts of DC directly from the battery. And with our available equipment, which we call the enablement bundle, a bidirectional inverter, a home hub, and a dark start battery, you can now power your home with that. So this to us is really where we want to bring our GM Energy portfolio in the future. But it doesn't stop there. There are customers who are super interested in owning their own energy destiny. They want to get off the grid. So we've also got options that allow more flexible energy generation or storage. So you can purchase a stationary energy storage battery, which is our GM Energy Ultium, our GM Energy Power Bank, or connect to solar with one of our preferred providers. So You have the ability to take the energy in the vehicle. You have the ability to take energy from the sun, and you can do it all with GM Energy.
And I know you talked about the Silverado having that capability. Mm-hmm. Will the Blazer have that bidirectional capability as well?
We've announced that all of our Ultium vehicles by 2026 will have vehicle-to-home capability with the Blazer and the rest of the family to come later next year.
Okay, so right now, if you buy a Blazer, it doesn't have that capability, but at some point...
We have unlocked the capability.
So the hardware is there, but you just haven't turned it on yet.
Yeah. Okay. With the available hardware, offboard hardware, you've got that capability.
Okay. So people buy a Blazer now, they will at some point have that available to them.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. And I know one of the projects that's previously been announced was a partnership with PG&E here in California.
Yeah.
To pilot some remote management of charging using that bidirectional capability, having it being managed from at the utility level. Mm-hmm. How's that project going along?
Yeah, we're continuing to work with PG&E. We'll have more to announce as we get closer to having an example to show everyone, but it is progressing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Anything else on charging or energy that we haven't talked about?
To wrap it up, it all starts with education, right?
Yeah.
That's the basis.
Before we finish up, I forgot about that. I wanted to get back to that education part of it. Mm-hmm. You talked about that at the beginning of this conversation, because I think education really is important, especially for first-time EV buyers,
sure.
Because the way you use an EV and charge an EV is fundamentally different from a gas vehicle.
Yeah.
You pull up to a gas pump. Doesn't matter if your tank is bone dry or three quarters full. You stick the nozzle in there and it pumps the same fuel. It pumps the fuel at the same rate until it's full.
Sure.
It's different. It's fundamentally different with an EV. The lower state of charge charges faster, eventually ramps down to protect the battery.
Sure.
And so is that part of what you're teaching both your retail partners, dealers, as well as the customers?
It is. We want to make sure we highlight the different types of charging, whether it's level one charging on your 120-volt outlet, level two, 240, where you're getting a consistent power into the vehicle, or to what you mentioned with DC fast charging, help to understand the different power levels and the capability of the vehicle, plus the capability of the equipment that you're charging at. So that is all part of the education, because if you don't understand that, it could lead to some frustrating experiences.
Yeah. All right. So final wrap up.
Yeah. So at GM Energy, we are committed to providing solutions for every customer. And it all begins with this product ecosystem that we're building, plus our work on public charging to make sure that we've got those great solutions accessible for all of our customers.
All right. Thank you very much, Derek.
Thanks, Sam. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.